Welcome to Create Your Bliss with me. Interviews with people who have created a life that engages their soul and expresses their soul's purpose. And today we have Dr. John J. Pilch. Dr. John J. Pilch was born in Brooklyn, educated in the Midwest, earned his PhD from Marquette in 1972. Leading study tours to the Middle East provided firsthand experiences of that culture and its values. He was assistant clinical professor in the Department of Preventive Medicine, Medical College of Wisconsin for 14 years, focusing on medical anthropology as it helps to appreciate healing in the modern and ancient worlds. He taught at the Cultural World of the Bible for 18 years in Georgetown University. He currently lectures in the Odyssey program at Johns Hopkins University. All of his audiences have appreciated the fresh light that Middle Eastern culture and values shed on ancient literature from that part of the world. His publications on the Middle Eastern cultural world of the Bible and on healing in the ancient world are well known in the U.S. and abroad. And he has a wonderful book out called Flights of the Soul, Visions, Heavenly Journeys, and Peak Experiences in the Biblical World. Welcome, John. And please
Thank you.
About your work and your book.
Well, the book you mentioned, Flights of the Soul, is a collection of articles probably spanning almost 20 years, I guess. I haven't checked or counted. But it goes way back to about 1998, 99. I was working on a commentary on the Book of Revelation and the Bible with my colleague, Bruce Molina. And he suggested looking at Dr. Felicitas Goodman's work, which I did. Now, the interesting thing about the Book of Revelation is four times in that book, the author, John, explicitly says he's in trance. The Greek words he uses literally say in spirit. It's not Holy Spirit, not spirit. It really means, the dictionaries will say, it means in trance. He was in trance. And when he was in trance, in these four instances, he took journeys to the sky. He said, I saw an open door in the sky, and the voice said, come here, and I did. And then he went to a high mountain and so on. So this is what totally intrigued me. And we worked on a Book of Revelation commentary, discovering that it had nothing to do with the end of the world. It really was not at all about Rome. Rome is never mentioned in there. And what it tried to answer was the questions of the early believers after Jesus died and was raised from the dead. Where is he now? What's he doing? So that Book of Revelation tries to answer that, and he is in the sky, as John says. So he takes a trip up to the sky, and in the constellations he sees God's will for all eternity spelled out. So the book is about the constellations in the sky. For example, when he makes a reference to seeing the lamb, I saw a lamb, and people think about an animal lamb. It's really not the animal, the lamb, because he says, I saw a lamb standing, that means it would be alive, as if dead. Well, how could a lamb be standing and look dead? Well, up in the sky, the constellation Aries, on all sky charts, is shown standing. And he's looking back over his back. He's looking at the next constellation, which is Taurus. In real life, if a lamb were like that, he'd be dead because his neck was turned all the way around. That would be a dead lamb. So it's things like this. It's insights like this. And looking at the Book of Revelation, that I was helped very much by the work of Felicitas Goodman, the anthropologist, and her pioneering work in trance and trance experiences. So that's been very, very helpful for me in my work.
So you keep mentioning trance and trance experiences. So can you talk a little bit about what her work was and how it works for you, or how what her work is and how that connected to your research? This is fascinating.
Anthropologists point out, one of my favorite anthropologists, his name is Victor Crapanzano, did his work in Morocco. He identified 35 different levels of awareness that human beings pass through every day, or we call them states of consciousness. So I often ask my students, have you ever gone someplace, if you drive a car, and you reached your destination, but you don't remember how? Mm-hmm. And you kept all the rules. You observed everything correctly. You didn't break any laws. You were in a trance. It's called road trance. Your body knows automatically how to get to where you're going. It's not a strange place. And your mind is somewhere else. You're in an altered state of consciousness or alternate state of consciousness. Same thing with people who, for example, if they use alcohol. Well, if you have one drink, two drinks, or three drinks of alcohol, you know that it changes your level of awareness. And you do things that perhaps you wouldn't do ordinarily. And I used to ask my students, too, since class began 10, 15 minutes ago, how many of you have not been here? And they would look at me. And I'd say, your body is here, but you've been thinking about something else. You've been elsewhere. That's it. Alters. So scholars have identified at least 35 different levels like this that we go through. 35 different levels. And so we pass through them throughout the day, usually in like 90-minute intervals. If you think about the schedule, of daily schedule of a person, within 90-minute intervals, you need a break, and you have to have a little distraction. But within that time, even professional counselors who use hypnotism say that it's possible in that 90-minute period to help a person reach hidden parts of their problems, of their concerns and their issues, and they're able to face them and address them. So these are, and the interesting thing about these trance experiences is that they are not necessarily induced. That is to say, you don't have to smoke anything or drink anything to get into them. They're normal human experiences. We call them pan-human. All human beings are capable of them. In fact, Dr. Goodman's mentor at Ohio State University, Erica Bourguignon, did some research on a database at Yale University. It's called the Human Relations Area Files. And this covers all the cultures of the world. And what she discovered was that some 95% of the cultures in the world experience alternate states of consciousness precisely without smoking or drinking anything. They're automatically. You can induce them. They can be induced as well. But and it's possible if all conditions are appropriate. But ordinarily, it's a normal human capacity. And the interesting thing about this normal human capacity is we in the West don't trust it. So we in the West are very suspicious because in order to have this experience, you kind of have to give up control. You have to let things take over for themselves. And there's one thing we don't want to do is give up control. So I have a psychiatrist colleague at the Harvard University, Arthur Kleinman. He points out the problem with this is that people in the West have developed sort of a policeman who keeps a guard over what they're thinking and how they're behaving and saying, uh-oh, you can't do that. No, that's not scientific. That's not correct. That's not appropriate. You have to let that go. You have to just divorce yourself from that, and you'll have the experience. It's possible for everybody to have this experience.
That's wonderful, and to really understand that we have something that we've turned off. I was thinking earlier when you were talking about road trance that probably in before we got into modern life, that a lot of daily life was ritualized or habitual, so we spent a lot of time in those.
Mm-hmm. Well, the story in the Acts
of Awareness, yeah.
Right. The story in the Acts of the Apostles of the Apostle Paul, when he was, before he accepted Jesus in his life as a meaningful person, he was angry with these people who he felt were betraying his traditions. And so the story tells us that he's on the road to Damascus. Well, very likely he's walking. If he's not walking, he's riding a donkey. In the ancient world, the horse was a war animal, and you didn't ride horses unless you were going to war. Well, he wasn't going to war. He was just trying to find these people and call them to account. And it's along the road that he has this trance experience. So you don't necessarily even need an automobile for that to happen.
Right.
It could happen in any way. Even walking, it could happen.
Well, and I'm sure, you know, I know domestic chores will do it, and I'm sure if you're planting or doing corn or, you know, or planting wheat or herding or whatever, that you kind of get into that.
Yes, kind of repetitive behaviors, things that don't necessarily require your full attention. that you can do them almost like on automatic pilot. So while you're doing this, your mind is doing something else. Your mind is saying, okay, I'm going to be harvesting this, or I'm going to be picking these berries, but I'm thinking about something else. And then you have the nice experience of in an alternate state of awareness.
That's so interesting, because I think one of the things that I'm hearing more and more in the scientific world is that, you know, quantum mechanics, which was to sort of explain how we experience the world, is having to take more and more of that into account.
Yes, indeed. There was a film, I think the name of the film was What the Bleep Do I Know, or something like that. It was a fascinating film, and one of my colleagues from Georgetown was featured in it, Candace Pert. She died not too long ago.
Yeah.
But that was, for me, an eye-opening experience in the sense of opening me to knowledge about quantum physics and how all of this works. But it's absolutely fascinating, because these are all human capacities. You don't need necessarily any kind of special training. You just need to be able to focus and want to do it. You have to be open to it. If you're suspicious of it, or if you don't trust it, or you think that you're concerned and worried that something bad is going to happen, well, no. The evidence indicates nothing bad will happen. These are human capabilities. Human beings are all able to do this. They just have to let go and let it happen.
Do you think there's a tie between being able to do this and our inner policemen and our current levels of stress and unhappiness? That just occurred to me as you were talking, because I'm thinking.
It's possible. Sometimes what happens in stress is the more you're stressed, the more you worry about it, and then you get more stressed, and it's sort of like a vicious circle. If you can remove yourself from that in a certain sense, you can achieve calm and peace and perhaps even resolution to whatever's stressing you, and you'd be able to dispose of it. I think that we were talking about this last evening when you said someone, one of your clients or one of your friends who had been experiencing stress or problems or concerns got involved in the method, and in like 2 year time it vanished, it disappeared. It just wasn't there anymore. It can happen that way. That's a very, very strong possibility.
So how did learning about the trance and then experiencing these events, how did that inform your studies and your understanding?
Well, it's fascinating because I specialize in the Bible and ancient documents and reading them on their own terms, within their own context. So in the book of Genesis, chapter 5, there's a story of, there's a list of patriarchs, 10 people who lived before the flood. And one of these people is named Enoch. And he's only mentioned very briefly, I think maybe one verse, two verses in the Bible, and it says Enoch lived to be so old, whatever it was, 100 years, 600 years, whatever. And then it says, and he was no more, and he walked with God. Well, when the people read this, they wondered, where did he go? It doesn't say he died. He was with God. Where did he go? Now, this document, this report, is dated about 400 B.C., and that's about the time that the people at Qumran, the Dead Sea, were thriving. And so in this 400 B.C., in this period, people were fascinated in the Israelite tradition. They were fascinated with this fellow Enoch, and suddenly books started to appear, claimed to be written by him. Of course, they weren't written by him, but other people were writing as if he had written the book, the books of Enoch. And in these books, it tells you where he went after God took him. And what the books say is that he went up to the sky, and he visited all the different skies that there were, 9 of them, and who was inhabiting each level of the sky and whatnot. And these are fascinating books. And the second book of Enoch, we only have a Slavonic version of it. One of the interesting points is that what's going to happen when you die and get up there to the sky? Are you going to audition for the heavenly choir and sing with the angels? Well, I like that very much because I'm a singer. And I said, oh, good, I'll be ready for my audition. I'll be able to do that. But the important point about this book of Enoch is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found 50 copies of it. So among that community there at the Dead Sea. So it indicates that this was a very significant book for them. They had 50 copies, considering how difficult it was to copy books in
right.
those ancient times, that they had 50 copies. So what scholars believe is that the people who lived there, they sort of left society and moved into this place and lived as a community. The people who lived there used the books of Enoch. There are maybe four of them. They use them as scripts. They believe that if we read these books and do what's in here, we can have the same experience.
Oh,
and
wow.
So they consider the books of Enoch and other parts of the Bible as a script for fulfillment, that if you do it, what you're reading about is going to happen in your life. And that's a fascinating insight for me. And that's where the work of Felicitas Goodman came into play, because they said, aha, she too had claimed that this is a normal human experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a mental deficiency. It's not a mental illness. It's a healthy thing. Normal people do have it, and people who are interested in it should pursue it without any fear. And it will bring rich rewards. The experience itself will bring rich rewards. So it was her insights and her experiments with her students and other clients that helped me to appreciate how valuable this was for interpreting these ancient documents like the Bible. I did take a workshop with Dr. Goodman in 1990 at
mm-hmm.
Cuyamungi in Santa Fe. And so, yes, that's how I got introduced to the method. And while she favored Native American traditions, I personally favor my Roman Catholic traditions, my Christian traditions, because that's what I know very well. And it helped me to energize, to vivify these things, which had been dead letters on a page, saying, I wonder why they did this. I wonder how come they did that. When I was in various Christian practices, there's the practice of meditation. Well,
mm-hmm.
the big challenge was not to fall asleep. If you were sitting in the group and meditating, you didn't want your head to go bobbing, indicating to everybody else, you're not meditating, you're sleeping. So you spent most of the time figuring out strategies. How can I hold my chin or whatever so that my head won't bob in case I fall asleep,
right.
which I'm very likely to do. But once I found Felicitas' work, then I realized, oh, this is how you're supposed to do it correctly and properly, and this is what it's supposed to produce. So to me, it's been very, very helpful, very, very fascinating, and very rewarding. In the Bible as well, the prophets have visions. They get their call from God in visions.
Mm-hmm.
And an interesting piece of information in the book of Samuel, first book of Samuel, chapter 3, it said, the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision. Well, what's significant about that is, according to the Bible, that's how God routinely, normally, communicates with human beings through alternate states of consciousness, through trance, through visions.
Uh-huh.
And if you can induce it, good. And if not, it could happen spontaneously as well. And as a Catholic and attending Mass, every Catholic Mass, just before the consecration, it has a prayer called a preface. And every one of those prefaces concludes with the words, and so with the angels and archangels, we say, Holy, 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 Lord God of Hosts. Well, Holy, 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 Lord God of Hosts is a quote from Isaiah chapter 7, and it's a report of his vision in a temple. So in other words, whoever put the Mass together in early times was saying to those who are participating, get ready now. You'll be able to go into trance, and you'll be able to see God, you'll be able to meet Jesus in trance at this time. And that's what the Mass was intended to do.
Wow.
Whether people do it or not, I don't know. I have a book which published before the Flights of the Soul called Visions and Healing in Acts of the Apostles. In Acts mm-hmm. of the Apostles, there are more than 20 reports. There are 26 chapters in that book. there are more than 20 reports of people going into trance. Just about every chapter, someone's going into trance. So I have a very small commentary, maybe a little more than 100 pages, where I highlight the trance experiences. And then at the conclusion of my book, I have a couple of appendices in which I say, and this is how it can happen for a believer at Mass, and this is how it can happen outside of Mass. And this is a good method that you could use. Developing Felicitas's insights, Dr. Goodman's insights,
right.
Adapting them to the Christian rituals and saying, this is how I've made sense out of it. And it's been that's almost 14, 15 years ago that I first encountered this, and it's been richly rewarding for me ever since that time.
That's really fascinating. And as you talk about this, you've talked about how wonderful it is, and I do know this myself, that you don't need anything to induce it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need drugs or, it doesn't need to
push.
And it occurred to me that maybe part of the whole cultural use of that is how do you disengage with the policeman. It was just
And that takes an effort. That takes a lot of effort. Because we are so accustomed, culture comes with mother's milk. You can't do anything about it. And you have to, if you become aware of your cultural properties, then at some point you should be able to, or try to be able to disengage from them and saying, I don't have to do it that way. It can be done a different way. I can allow myself the freedom to do this. I think it's the Alcoholics Anonymous that have this statement or saying that they repeat, let go, let God.
Right.
And that would be something to do with this policeman. Let go, let God. Let that policeman go. Get rid of the policeman. There's no need to have this policeman in your life. I was always very grateful for that psychiatrist, Arthur Kleinman, who pointed this out. And he says it's only in the West. In fact, between him, Kleinman, and Erica Bourguignon,
mm-hmm.
their point is that it's not the people who are having this experiences that need to explain. It's the people who don't have the experiences who need to say why they're not having the experiences. Since 90% of the population on the face of the planet have the experiences, normally without, as I said, smoking or drinking anything, without necessarily inducing it.
And one of the things that I find really useful for the ritual of an ecstatic event, and Dr.
Mm-hmm.
Goodman did it with a rattle and certain postures.
Yes,
and some
yes.
kind of structure around that, but that it's very unscripted, so that the experiences that one has.
Yes.
are completely defined by one's own connection to the divine, whatever that may be. And there's no
absolutely.
There's no direction. Well, now you go here and you go to this place and you go in and the divine shows up and you have a conversation.
Right.
Or you listen, depending on your.
Yes, you're right. Dr. Goodman relied on, and they still use in the Institute, drumming and mainly rattling. And
mm-hmm.
the point of that is to overstimulate the nervous system, and when it overstimulates, when it gets overstimulated, then it can relax and be capable of having this alternate state of consciousness experience. However, in Christianity, we can achieve the same with music, like chant, Gregorian chant.
Yes.
Or there's a music that I really like from Thésée, France, that Thésée community. It's very relaxing, restful, and trance-inducing music. Or the incense and the bells. I had a colleague at Georgetown who was a professor of German. And somehow, I don't remember now, he was connected with key neuroscientists, namely DeQuilly and Newberg, two physicians
mm-hmm.
who have written extensively from a scientific perspective about trance experiences. Well, his name is Father Murphy. So Father Murphy, the Jesuit Father Murphy, used those insights and did an analysis of the Mass, and he said, look, if you look at the Roman Catholic Mass, it has all the elements that you need for inducing trance. The ringing of the bells, the procession, there's a word for calling this, bringing entrainment, bringing everybody together to sort of form a community and to have a common experience. So I have a reference to that in my, as I said, my little book, Their Visions and Healing and the Acts of the Apostles. What was also helpful for me is some years ago, I joined a group in Budapest, Hungary, called the International Society for Shamanistic Research. And they publish articles and materials, and they have a conference every 2 years. And one of the conferences, I went and made a report on the Chilton spirits. I was able to get reports from different participants, and I used them, put them all together, combined them into a report, and said, this is how, in this particular group, the use of this posture produces such experiences and such results. And it was fascinating, and the group was also interested. And much to my surprise, it seems that Dr. Goodman, early in her career, had attended these conferences. So they were familiar with her work, and every so often when she attended, she would remind them of it. So at that particular meeting that I attended, there were two things that really stunned me. One was one fellow did research, and he said, you don't need to have a felicitous belief that you need to rattle 120 beats a minute for 15 minutes. This was her research. Well, he said in his research, it didn't matter how many beats a minute, and it didn't matter how long, that you could, once you set the ritual up, it could work quickly or it might take a long time. It doesn't make a difference. It's not so significant. So even though there are differences of opinion, the fact is that ritual is important. And whatever personal ritual one designs for oneself, it could work. If you practice it and if you become expert at it or adept at it, it would be very useful for you all the time. When I'm on my way, the group that I meet with is in Annapolis, Maryland, and I live in Baltimore. So it's about a 30-40 minute drive to get down there, and we meet every Tuesday morning. So during the drive, I pop in Teze music and I listen to that. That sort of prepares me. It prepares me for our getting together and for the event and experience we're going to have. And then when I'm driving home, I review the experience. I think about what is it that we had, what is it that we experienced, what is it that we shared. And I find myself revising it. I say, oh, okay, no, I think I would do it this way. I think that it means this. I didn't think of that. It's not a solitary event. It's an ongoing event in life, and it stays with you if you allow it to. And it's, as I said, very insightful, and it helps with many, many aspects of your own personal life.
I think that's the part I find really fascinating, and I don't know if that's because it takes us into other parts where we access other kinds of wisdom, and I think it also,
yes,
we move to a place where instead of feeling so isolated, we understand that we are a part of the whole because we allow ourselves to experience it.
Yes. On the other hand, we have to deal with our human limitations. Felicitas said that the experience itself is vacuous. What that means is the trance experience is just that, and you have to interpret it. And
right,
the best interpreter is the one who had it. So you are your own best interpreter. Now, where do you get the interpretation from? Well, what scholars point to, they call it the latent cultural discourse.
Mm.
Because of my Catholic tradition, I'm not likely to see Buddha.
Right.
And I'm not likely to see Confucius, things outside of my tradition.
Right.
I'm not saying they don't exist or I don't believe in them. I'm simply saying they're not part of my tradition. So it's not likely that that's going to be part of my experience. That's why it's so important to respect what each person is probing, what each person concludes, and to support it and to say, well, I can't follow that at all, but it makes sense to you, and I encourage you to pursue it further, investigate it further, and see what comes out of it. So that's very, very significant.
It is, and I one of the things that I know that a great many people experience is a sense of compassion from being the recipient of compassion.
Yes, yes. Just last week, we're on a little break now with our Annapolis group, but just last week, we got together, and I forgot, I think we did the Children's Spirits, sitting there, and afterwards, after we have the experience, then we record what each of us has experienced and share it.
Mm-hmm.
So in the sharing, I had to say, well, I'll tell you, this was an interesting experience for me today because there were no visuals. I didn't see anything. And I didn't hear anything. There was no message. But two times within the 15 minutes, I felt this deep peace, like completely relaxing. Just amazing. Just amazing. The first, early on, maybe the 4 or 7 minutes into the 15-minute period, it just kind of settled on me. And then I got agitated and lost it, and then a little bit later it came back again. So yes, it's possible to feel all different kind of things, including, as you said, compassion and other emotions of this nature, because you're tapping into something that's hidden in the human potential. It's buried there, and you just have to surface it.
Yeah, and acknowledge it.
Yes.
You brought up something that I think is fascinating, because one doesn't have the same experience with the same posture every time.
No, exactly so, right, yes. In fact, I've come to the point now where I'm not even sure the postures are necessary. Part of it is due to my arthritis.
Right.
I say to myself, I can't do some of these postures. I don't know how people in the ancient world did them.
Right.
How did they get their bones to bend in this way? I can't, not anymore. And so I realized that perhaps the posture is not so significant as the intention. You have to go with the intention. You have to want to have the experience, or at least make yourself open to the experience. Because if you're talking about experiencing God, which is what I'm interested in, well,
right,
then God's going to be an active partner. And God may say, I'm too busy today. Don't bother me. I got
mm-hmm.
something else to do. So you're going to have an empty 15 minutes or whatever. I'm just joking,
right,
of course.
But, you know,
but the point is that I was at a conference once at Columbia University sharing these insights, and someone accused me of manipulating God. I said, no, I'm not manipulating God.
I didn't know you were so powerful.
Yeah, exactly so. I said, you know, Jews observe the Sabbath. They go every Sabbath, sundown on Sabbath to sundown the next day. Is that manipulating God? No, it's saying here's the opportunity that we think would be a good opportunity. Maybe it'll work today. Maybe it won't work today. And the same thing with Catholics who go to Mass. Well, maybe it'll work today. Maybe it won't work today. Depends. You have to allow God's freedom.
And whatever the message might be.
Sure, yes, indeed, right.
I found it very interesting because one of the things we do in the group I lead is there's a body work called Feldenkrais that was discovered by a man named Moshe Feldenkrais.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if you've heard of it, but basically, so he thinks that, and I think he was one of the original people who worked with embodying the fact that if you can imagine it, it has the same effect on your nervous system if you actually do it. So for those postures, like the tendency diviner, which is a little more difficult than not.
Right. Yes.
We have tried for people for whom it's too difficult to hold that image in their head or in postures where you have to hold your hands up for the entire time.
Right, yes.
To image that, and that seems to reduce the amount of physical pain and allow that if it's necessary. But I'm like you. I'm not sure It's necessary.
Yes. My voice teacher uses a variety of methods, and Feldenkrais is one of them. In performance, how do you get a good performance? How do you manage to sing something decently and so forth? Well, she has a variety. She uses all of these methods. She employs them, and if she'll present them to you and say, now, if this works for you, okay, and if not, well, let's try a different one.
Right.
So, yes, the Feldenkrais is very, very helpful. Yeah, but I tell you that the lessons from arthritis, good old Arthur.
It's a little restrictive. So I have a question, too, because I know in Dr. Goodman's work we don't do sounding and we don't dance. But if you're a singer, it would be interesting for you to discuss how that's a trance and how that ritual becomes a vehicle or not for that trance.
Yes. I sang professionally, and I sang with 5 opera companies in the past, and not now. And I sing with choruses now. But I share this with my teacher, and she agrees with it, my voice teacher, that in order to get a good performance, you do have to go into trance. And she said, watch Pavarotti. If you see recordings of him, watch the expression on his face. Like when he finishes singing, it takes maybe like half a minute or so for him to come out of it. And I have to admit that this has been my experience in performance, that if I'm having a good performance, I will be in trance. And then at the end, I have to come out of it, because the trance is what makes for a very fine performance. It's like really living into it. So whether I especially like the requiems. We do a lot of the requiems, and those are very moving. This weekend we're doing Beethoven's 9th. It's not so easy to do that because it's really challenging for the human voice. But there are 2 other smaller pieces we're doing, and one's by Haydn, also another one by Beethoven. And it does help. So with my voice lessons and with my vocal performances, it'll be a good performance if I can get into trance, and usually I can. The music just carries you away, and the performance, because you know the text and you know the music so well, it's just like an automatic pilot. You just go along with it. And they're very fascinating experiences.
So you were talking about the effect of music?
Yes, in performance, particularly
in performance.
On the one hand, we mentioned earlier that music, for me, is an inducement, just like drumming and rattling and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But also in performance, it's an expression. So whether I was singing in the opera, and in Ballo in Masquerade. It's in Faust. In Faust.
Mm-hmm.
In Faust, when Valentin is dying after he loses in a duel with the devil, and his pregnant sister comes and says, oh, my brother, you're dying. And he says to her, oh, my sister, I hate you, that even if God forgives you, I damn you, and I die a brave soldier. Well, I've never been able to perform that scene without wanting to go and kick him in the head and say, my God, you're dying, and your sister is very concerned, and here you are cursing her with your dying breath. So, I mean, a good performance and a good script will draw you into the story and the action. And also, if you're, as a performer, involved in it, you make it all the more potent and all the more significant for the audience. I also now with choruses, I sing with choruses now, so we're talking about the various requiems. They really put me into trance, and a number of other things. We did a nice performance last year or 2 years ago. You probably heard of Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit paleontologist.
Yeah.
So when he was in China, he was not able to say mass. I didn't have all the stuff, so he wrote something called Mass on the World, and it's a beautiful text, and an American, Tina Davidson, set it to music, and we performed that, and I have to say it was one of the most delightful experiences I ever had, good trance experience, not only because of Teilhard's lyrics, but because of Tina's music. So these are significant, for me, very significant. I also mentioned about Pavarotti, if you study him. In fact, look at the singers. Very often, after when they finish, there's this time, 30 seconds, 1 minute, when they sort of like coming out of it and coming back to reality, as it were, again.
Well, and I think, and it's lovely because I do think that that's one of the places and one of the great draws of opera, and that kind of beautiful music that does, that is intentioned to carry us.
Yes.
That the wonderful thing about doing these in community and in a group and how healing and transformative and bonding that is.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
You
indeed.
Know,
I remember once coming home from our opera rehearsal. I was living in Milwaukee. My wife was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And she was watching something on TV. And it was a musical performance. And I was talking to her about the evening, the experience. And all of a sudden, on the screen came Baryshnikov, and he was dancing to music by Chopin.
Mm-hmm.
And the next, whatever it was, 10, 15 minutes, I just completely kind of lost track of where I was. I was drawn up into the music because of my Slavic spirit connecting with that Slavic spirit, the Slavic spirit in the music, and the Slavic spirit of the dancer and the composer, all of this. And it's only when it ended that I kind of fell back down to earth and said, oh, yeah, we're like, where was I? What was I telling you about?
That magical, and I think that that's one of the things that makes certain performances so moving, and that and certain performers' ability to do that really.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, right.
Even through, because I watched the Met live in HD, and even through that, there are certain singers more than others who just carry you. They become a vehicle, and their expression of it, and I don't know quite where we're going, except it's to that place where they're...
Sure, sure. No, it's always a very pleasant experience. Yes.
And I think that there, I know that one of the things Felicitas has talked about is that the human, there is a human need for ritual. And I don't know if Maslow talks about that or not, but the basic needs are those.
Right. Oh, yes. Some years ago, I was teaching a course on ritual in Portland, Oregon, and I was going to the library, and I found a fascinating collection of articles just serendipitously here and there. One was in a nursing journal. Someone analyzed behavior in the operating room, and they called it a ritual. Indeed, everyone in the operating room in surgery has a role to play, and they have to do it a certain way, how you handle the instruments and how you interact with each other and pass each other so as not to, so as to avoid the contamination and so forth and so on. It's fascinating. And then I found another interesting article about ritual at McDonald's. So ritual permeates our life. I don't know that we could exist without it. I don't know that life would make sense without it. And you think about it. I know that when I reflect upon it, I think, whoa, my life has been quite disciplined from my earliest formation education and still remains disciplined. And what that discipline is basically rooted in ritual. I have to do things a certain way, and if it's not that way, it's not going to be right. That's not going to work.
Yes. Right.
And the ritual not only gives assurance, that it's going to turn out correctly, but it's very orderly, and it makes sure that, because I don't know that we can live with chaos. So chaos is very difficult. So, yeah.
Well, and it's very hard to create something if you have to create every step along the way.
Absolutely, yes, yeah.
So if you ritualize certain things, if you have a goal, if the process gets ritualized, so each one of those decisions does not have to be an act of will, so that
the act
of will or the act of intention then really goes into...
Yes. With the little bit that I know about human development, they say that this begins even in a womb, where the infant... has to learn shortcuts quickly. Otherwise, if they had to make a decision every time, they, for example, after birth, they see this animal, is this a dangerous animal or is this a friendly animal? Can I approach it and pet it, or do I have to run and so forth and so on? Now, once you learn that certain animals are dangerous or risky, you know, you don't have to go through the ritual. You don't have to go through it each time to assess and evaluate what should I do in this situation. Yeah.
Right, that you build up your repertoire.
Yeah, exactly so, right, yeah, yeah.
And then it's interesting because I do find also that these tools are helpful to us in breaking down some of that ritualized behavior that's not useful. I mean, I feel that trance and ritual connection to the divine religious ceremony, is very helpful with PTSD, with addiction. I mean, that's why in AA they say let go and let God is to move outside of, I think, that sense of paralysis and
mm-hmm.
fear, so that you just want to distract yourself in another way.
Yes, yes. And the ritual is all around us, and since we live in community for the most part, the community ritual keeps us going. So sometimes if we're sort of in the daze or not really fully attuned, the community ritual will carry you along till you get back in the groove again.
Yes, and why our communities, that's very true. And part of our role in community is to be that for other people as well.
Yes, absolutely, yes, yeah.
Keep the ritual going so that. Well, utterly fascinating. So as we wind down, do you have some words of wisdom? Do you have a line of song you want to share with us?
No, I'm just happy to have this opportunity to share these insights. As I said, for me, I'm grateful when people respect my religious traditions, and I'm not saying everybody should be like this. I don't promote it for everybody, but what I'm saying is that if you have a tradition, take a look at it in case it's become boring to you or meaningless, and say, you know, maybe I'm not doing it correctly. Maybe there's richness here that I'm overlooking. I'm looking at treasures and not seeing them. So that's what happened to me. I mean, this has been my tradition for all of my life. I was born Roman Catholic and raised very well and know the tradition, also educated in it very well. But it wasn't until I met Felicitas and read her works that I realized, whoa, that's how it should be. This is how it ought to work. This is why we do what we do. There's a probably old story that everybody knows or heard. A young lady was preparing a roast for her family, and she cut it in half and put it in a roaster and whatnot. And she often wondered why the hell she did this, but it's because her mother did it.
Mm-hmm.
So she asked her mother one day, how come you always cut the roast this way? And the mother said, because they didn't have a pot big enough to put it in.
Right, and what turns into, right, ritual and what you,
exactly.
Where's the... Yes.
Exactly. So that's what we need to do, and that's what I would encourage people to do. Take a fresh look at your rituals, at your traditions, and see if they've become dead and boring to you. Maybe they need to be reexamined and brought back to life again. Maybe that they haven't been practiced or haven't been giving you the full benefit of what they are intended to accomplish. Because over the thousands of years that these rituals have existed, they have worked. They've been effective for us. Somewhere along the line, we lost. We didn't know why we do these things. We just do them.
Yeah, and it becomes habit as opposed to
engaged
ritual.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And
how to nurture that. Well, Dr. John Pilch, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, indeed.
Yeah, I hope to talk to you again. Actually, you're encouraging me to go back and enjoy the ritual of research and integrating.
Oh, yes. I can't live without it.
Well, it's fascinating, and as we understand from deeper levels and start... looking, at least for me, looking at the deeper understandings and these threads that draw us all together as humans.
Right, right.
And what are our common experiences,
mm-hmm.
and how can we heal some of these conflicts that are going on in the world that
Yeah. Well, Americans like to talk about, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. I'm never sure exactly what that means, but spirituality, the definition that I like is that it's a way of life based on experience of transcendence, or in my case, I would call it God, and shaped in response to that experience. So the important point to experience is at the heart of it. If you're not experiencing anything, if life is just dull or dead, then that's an impoverished humanity. But you have to work on sharpening one's experience and being able to experience everything that comes along. And the experience would include transcendence, or as I said, in my case, it's experiencing God. And then once you have such an experience, you respond to that experience. And then that's your way of life, based on that experience. That's what's so precious to me about the trance work that we do and with the Annapolis group that, as I said, 14 years, and I miss it if we don't do it. There are times when we have conflicts and we can't get together. So I look forward. Sometimes it's a long time. Sometimes it'll be, it may be a few weeks. But it's always good to get back together and to renew the contacts, and also to get back into this communal activity. We do it as a group, and it really makes sense as a group. You could do it alone, but it has a better effect when you do it as a group.
Yes, that's been my experience as well, because you start building, I think what's called a morphogenic field or something that
you move
into. And I think that there's a lot of hunger for that in this country, that people are trying to create ways of doing that. And it's very interesting to think about revitalizing the traditions that one grows up in.
Yes. Modern technology certainly doesn't help. Actually, it complicates things. As you know, they have jokes or cartoons where people are sitting in a group and everyone's staring at their iPhone.
Or
texting each other, sitting next to each other and texting each other. Well, that's not community. So, it is very necessary, something that would be very helpful for us.
Yeah, to do. Well, again, thank you very much.
You're
I
welcome.
Really appreciate your taking the time.
Very welcome.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye now.